Imagine what it would be like guarding a president of the United States. What would it be like guarding three different ones? Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama. Well, today we have Ken Valentine coming on, and he did exactly that. We have an incredible culture here in the state of Alabama, but our politics and public policy don't reflect the people of Alabama. Media drives culture. Culture is what drives politics and public policy. Welcome, everyone, to 1819 News, the podcast. I'm Brian Dawson, CEO of 1819 News and host of this here podcast, where we're in pursuit of a free and flourishing Alabama every single week. We have a great episode for you guys today. We're bringing on Ken Valentine, who's a new author, but previous to being an author, he was a Secret Service agent for three sitting United States presidents. And so he's going to talk about his story, how he became a Secret Service agent, tell us some of those cool stories that I'm sure there's an infinite amount of that maybe he's allowed to tell us. I don't know. There may be some stuff there. But I also want to hear from him. What life lessons can we learn from someone who has spent their entire career ready to die for somebody else or take a bullet for somebody else? I think that could be really interesting. But before we jump into Ken's story, I want to talk to you guys about the importance of supporting the work we do at 1819 News and why it's necessary. At the end of the day, corporate sponsored journalism is a fairly new thing in the last 20 years, and it's why journalism is dead. It's the job of the journalist to hold those in power accountable. We speak truth to power and we scrutinize power as journalists. And a big portion of power is corporations. Corporations and government is your two main sources of power that journalists usually scrutinize. When you have the power paying the journalists are no longer incentivized to scrutinize the power. So when the corporations, be it Pfizer or Alabama Power, are paying for advertising on a news site, that news site is not going to do the work that they need to do to scrutinize power, ergo no journalism. And so the reason that we have to be citizen supported is that we work for the people. We are a news and media outlet for the people of Alabama. The left has their outlet with AL.com. The lobbyists and corporations have their outlet with Yellowhammer and Alabama Political Reporter, but the people didn't have a news and media outlet for them. And that is, at the end of the day, what we did was to create a news and multimedia outlet for the people of Alabama because we didn't feel like there was one. So it's imperative that you guys support us. We can't function without the support of our readers and our citizens. So please go to 1819news.com, click the button, become a member. Do that, and membership start as little as $5 a month. And with that, you're going to get access to behind-the-scenes content and merch and everything else. But more than anything, you will be supporting real news, real honest journalism. So please do that today. Well, Ken, thank you so much for taking the time to come down here. And
yes, sir. My pleasure.
You're in Birmingham?
Yes, sir.
So I actually had to drive farther for this podcast than you did. So I feel less bad that you're in studio.
That's all good. I was happy to do it.
Good, good, good. Well, man, you know, there's a lot of interesting careers out there. You see Mike Rowe, who kind of has his dirty jobs, and you see people with interesting jobs and some jobs that you may want to do and other jobs that you wouldn't want to do and other jobs that you kind of wonder how you could do. I would kind of file yours in maybe all three of those things that I just listed. As a former Secret Service agent who worked with three sitting U.S. presidents, my first question right off the bat that just kind of strikes me, how normal is that to be a Secret Service agent that works with three sitting U.S. presidents in their career? Is that unique?
Yes, sir. That is a little unique, I would say, and maybe that's why I keep saying that. I think you know, most people in their career get some exposure to presidential protection, but most agents don't do it full time.
Sure.
Much less with three sitting presidents. So it was a little unique. Very fortunate for me to be there from the transition of President Bill Clinton to George W. Bush, and then to be invited back during the presidency of Barack Obama. So a little unique.
Yeah, that's cool. And I want to talk to you, and we will end up doing an overtime segment. This just came to my mind. What we can talk about is the history of the Secret Service. How did it start? Why did it start? You know, all of those things. I think that'll be really good. And we'll talk about that on our overtime segment. I want to dive into that. I think it'll be very interesting. So you guys, if you do become members, you can have access to this segment where we talk about the origins of the Secret Service agency and how it came about, why, what did they originally do, what they're doing now, how all that came about. I think that'll be really interesting. Okay. Well, that's, again, I thought to sit under three presidents or sit, you know, serve three presidents is, I figured that was a big deal, but I wanted to confirm, you know, one of the things we love to do on 1819 News, the podcast, we just love to hear people's stories. And so we want to hear, you know, your story. Where were you born? Tell us about your parents. How in the world did you become a Secret Service agent? And then just hear some of the cool stories of being a Secret Service agent.
You bet. Well, thank you. And what a pleasure to get to talk to you about all this stuff. Yeah. It's one of my favorite subjects.
So, I bet.
You know, I grew up with a dad who was an FBI agent. So there was a little bit of that in the blood. My uncle had also been an FBI agent, but my dad stayed in to retirement. And so I think idolizing my dad had a lot to do with wanting to go into law enforcement. And I think as I approached the time where you had to start making decisions, making applications and whatnot, he really was the driving force behind saying, maybe you also need to look at Secret Service. And he'd had the opportunity to work on a Ronald Reagan visit with the Secret Service, so admired them, so enamored with just the people that they were and their demeanor and the way they carried themselves, maybe in contrast a little bit to his own agency. And so he was the one who really pushed me and said, you need to go apply. You need to check it out. You need to at least be open to the possibility. And when it came right down to it, the Secret Service won. And yeah. And there were some unique differences, I think, about the Secret Service that had my attention, starting with the fact that they were so small in comparison to the FBI. And in when we do the overtime part of this, I'll tell you the history behind that, because they are intertwined if you go back to the early 1900s. But they're so small. They had that dual mission of both protection and investigation, where the FBI was you know, the king of investigations federally. But there was something about the protection that drew me, and I went to the airport when Ronald Reagan arrived, and that my dad was participating in, and got to see that, got to see the agents in action, and see some of the moving parts there, and that really never left me. So when it came time for me to make my plans and make applications, Secret Service was top of my list, and so I was very grateful that they kind of won the race there. Mm. So.
Really cool. And so where did you say you grew up again? Did you mention that?
Well, my dad being the Tennessean, they would not let, back in the 60s, they wouldn't let a Southern guy serve in the South. So we were sent to Oklahoma and then Indiana. And so I really grew up in Indiana, but I always thought Tennessee was home.
Yeah.
And so, you know, every holiday, long weekend, birthday, and you know, all the holidays, we were in Tennessee, and so Knoxville, Tennessee was sort of our home base. And so when I graduated college and then law school, I was looking to get back to Tennessee, which I really hadn't even grown up there, but that's where all my family was, and my parents eventually moved back there when my dad retired.
Wow. And so I'm just going to share a little story with you. So a couple weeks ago, I had a gentleman named Angelo Fermo that came on my podcast. He was Department of Homeland Security. And before that, it was either U.S. Marshals or something that was kind of the equivalent before they did the, you know, Department of Homeland Security. I forget what the agency was. Federal law enforcement. But the reason I always ask people about their parents, and so it's very interesting, you said, and it goes to an undergirding theme in my show of biblical manhood, biblical masculinity, the importance of fathers. He grew up, and his father was in the cartels and was a big time drug dealer his entire life. He grew up watching his dad come in and out of prison, watching his dad do drug deals, watching all of this. And then he was sick of it, and he didn't want to live that lifestyle anymore. And so he pursued getting in law enforcement, and then he was going to get into federal law enforcement, where they send an agent to your house and do a bunch more investigation. And his dad had just gotten out of prison and showed up right as the federal agent was showing up to do the interview. And he sees his dad talking with the federal agent. He's like, oh my gosh, you know,
it's over.
It's over. And he ends up getting the job. And so he asks his dad, what did you say? He said, I stopped him and I said, please give my son the job so he doesn't turn into the man that I am.
Wow.
Right.
Oh, wow.
But the power of the father, right, to, you know, sent down the same course, but the importance of the father in that, and then in yours, I think on a much more, what we would be shooting for is you looked up to your father so much that you wanted to get into federal law enforcement, right? And so I just like seeing how those stories, because people's parents affect, you know, in where they come from, where they grew up, what they, you know, how they grew up, who their parents were. It usually shapes their story. And so I wanted to draw that out, and I did with you as well. What, so 92, that was when, was my math right? No, 4 years, would have been 4 years with Clinton. Okay. And so as you go into being a Secret Service agent, was there any hesitancy with, you know, the fact of what you're actually really doing is, you know, and again, so you brought up Reagan, you watched Reagan get shot, right, on TV or, you know, whatever. So I mean, that's,
absolutely,
you know, that's not that far away from when you decided to be a Secret Service agent. Is there something, are you crazy, or what would draw you into being the person that would jump in front of a bullet for someone, even if it was a president you might not like Clinton? Mm-hmm.
No, great question. I remember the Reagan shooting very, very well. I was in grade school at the time. I won't say what grade. But when we got on the school bus that afternoon, the bus driver said, you know, boys and girls, sit down. I need to tell you something. And she told us that the president had been shot. And there was some kid on the bus who cheered. And I remember that very, very well, because that really got under my skin. Yeah. that anybody would root for the downfall of our president, you know, whether you voted for him or not, So I think I had been enamored with the whole Kennedy shooting investigation.
Yeah.
And we had books at home about it. I think I had access to a lot of resources even at an early age. So then the Reagan shooting occurs. Fast forward to my dad participating in a Reagan visit as an intel guy, partnered up with the Secret Service. I think all of that kind of went into my decision tank to say, I want to do this. I'm not afraid necessarily of what could happen. I knew the realities, the chances of that are pretty small. But all of that, I think, drove me. I think that made it kind of interesting. The chance for some danger was actually a magnet and not a repellent. So, no, I think that was part of it for me. I think that was part of the draw for me to get in.
Interesting. So, you know, obviously, I want to hear about, you know, some of the stories of you being a Secret Service agent. I'm sure you probably have a ton of them, and maybe some of them you can talk about, some of them you can't. But what were maybe some examples of stories worth hearing, stories worth telling in your career?
Sure. I think the very first story I have is maybe for the listeners, it kind of gives you some perspective about the life of a Secret Service agent. So when I got out of the academy and two academies, you graduate, I go to my first office assignment in Louisville, Kentucky. So this is, you know, early fall of 96. When we arrive, I'm married. My wife and I have one car between us. The first day on the job, they give you your car. And the second day on the job, I was told, we need you to go to California for a Bill Clinton visit. And so I was sent out there to be in support of President Clinton going to a high school and some other stuff. But I had to get to the airport immediately. So I had to leave the office, go home, pack a bag for an uncertain amount of time. And this is before cell phones were terribly readily available.
Yeah.
And my wife is not there. And I remember leaving her a note on the table. We have boxes everywhere in our first little house. And I had to leave a note saying, I'm going to California. I'll call you when I get there if I can. And that was it. And so versus the home interview where the agent said, you'll always know where he's going. You'll always know when he gets there. That was part of it. And that lifestyle, that inability to know what your schedule is going to be like and what life is going to be like, that was a great eye-opening thing right off the bat, second day on the job. And I ended up being gone for about 3 weeks because they rolled me from that Clinton visit into the 96 Republican convention in San Diego, and I just didn't get to come home.
Wow.
The other fun part of that was that I'm brand new, I don't even have an earpiece, you know, the iconic earpiece. I don't even have one. So, so I had to borrow, you know, some part of one and head to California. Didn't even know how to get through the airport carrying a gun, and so many things that they don't teach you in the academy. You know, you learn how to fight and drive and do all this cool stuff. Well, the some of the practical aspects were left out of the training.
Yeah.
So I'm in California with a suitcase full of suits and, you know, dark shades and sunglasses, right? And the RNC is more of a neat casual affair. So it was sport coats and slacks, open collar kind of thing. And I was not prepared for that. So here's the rookie wearing a suit when, you know, he should be in down clothes. So it's just kind of a funny start to the career and, you know, not a terribly sexy story, but
that was the window into this, right? And that's what I think is going to be interesting to my listeners, viewers, however they get the podcast there, but is going to be just a window into the life of a Secret Service agent. We're all enamored by them. We see them. I've only had a few interactions. I got to meet President Trump back in August, the last August, and he has quite the Secret Service detail, and I want to talk to you more about that towards the end of the podcast. But it's just a very intriguing job, lifestyle, work. You know, there's an air of kind of secrecy about it, thus Secret Service, right? And so having a window into it is powerful. Well, let's talk about your wife, your children. When in this time period did you begin to start having children? And then, you know, I mean, that kind of lifestyle must have really, you know, taken a toll, or could have potentially taken a toll on your family.
Right. The adage in the Secret Service during my tenure, especially early on, was that law enforcement has the highest divorce rate of any profession.
Yeah.
And the Secret Service has the highest divorce rate in all of law enforcement. Wow. So I don't have any idea if that's true or not, but we certainly lived with that threat that, you know, maybe that some nugget of truth in there. It's a hard lifestyle. And I think for a marriage that's not well put together, it'll certainly test it. It's going to test every marriage, but ones that aren't well put together, that don't have a sure foundation, are going to have a hard time enduring the uncertainty, the travel, the moves, all, you know, you put it all together, and it's a tough way to make a living from a family standpoint.
Yeah.
But I married the most outstanding woman in the world, and I'm sorry, she's taken. So we've been married 31 years and we have 5 children. My wife Sandra is completely patient. She went into this with eyes wide open, but you know, you just don't know what you don't know. So we endured it one step at a time. And I think our faith is part and parcel to who we are. That was a foundational aspect of our marriage, is that we were both Christians. We're both believers. So, you know, us being led into the Secret Service, which is the way I look at it, seemed to be part of what God's plan was for us. Mm. And as we saw doors open and doors close, this one open, we were excited about that, and so we've approached it as if this is God's will for us. Now, I can tell you there were times when we were less than totally settled about that. It got hard. I remember the first time I was on the president's detail, 3 times I offered to quit, because it between having children and me traveling, it was a lot. Yeah. And 3 times we paused, we prayed, and determined that, no, I'm supposed to stay where I'm at. So I kind of like to joke, we prayed hard on the front end of me getting the Secret Service job. Yeah. This is what my heart was beating for. Didn't know how hard it might be. We also had been married for 5 years and had no children. So, and not for lack of trying, mind you. So we prayed hard about a career and about children, and God gave me this career, and over the next 9 years, I think I was home 5 times, and we have 5 children.
Oh. Yeah, there you go. That's funny. Wow. And then, you know, thinking about it, you know, obviously my life is nothing like that of a Secret Service agent, but, you know, the importance of having a supportive wife who's willing to, you know, man the home front when things can change on a whim and everything like that. I'm very blessed I have 7 children. And my wife's the same way. I'm like, hey, babe, I gotta go out of town for the next 3 days to go on this fundraising thing or whatever. She's just like, okay, that's it. It's never any complaint, never anything. So I realize not everyone has that. And I think God and his providence has, you know, been good to, sounds like, both of us. So
really. Well, cool. Amen. Sandra didn't just tolerate it. She supported it.
Yeah.
And I think that made a huge difference. My mentor likes to say that I need high octane fuel to do what I do. And as long as everything's okay at home, then I'm equipped and supported in going out, slaying the next dragon, running through the next wall. And when I knew that I had Sandra's support, kind of like in Rocky II, you know, go get them, go win. Yeah. Sandra was that wife that said, go get them. And it really enabled me, it emboldened me to go forth and do what had to be done. And a lot of time away from home, a lot of long hours and nights and, you know, going without the food, the sleep, the workouts, all the stuff that you would like to do.
Yeah.
But knowing that I had that support at home was a win.
Amazing. Good stuff. So what are some other crazy Secret Service stories? I mean, did you ever have any close calls? Did you ever have any, you know, or was it, how often are close calls? You know, I mean, I guess some of that stuff I think would be interesting.
There are always what we would consider a close call. You know, our job is to go out and ensure that whatever the president wants to do can be done safely.
Yeah.
And if we have to say no, you better be able to back that up.
Yeah.
With why can't you make that safe and secure? And so there are certainly some things that you really rather not make secure. But given the time and the resources, you can pretty much make anything secure. You can go in and sterilize an environment. You can make sure that he has the space and the ability to do what we elected the president to do.
Yeah.
There were times when we had to say we can, but we're going to need a lot more time. Or we'd rather not, and we'd rather you didn't do this or that. There were always times where we would do our very, very best, and unexpected still kind of takes you by surprise.
Yeah.
And so the things that maybe we hadn't thought about. I mean, there have been planes that have crashed into the White House before, little, you know, prop jets and whatnot. And there have been events where we got out of there kind of in the nick of time. And that's always, that's good because people rarely know kind of how close a call that was. The funniest one though, for me, and I wrote about it in the book was, the time that now tongue in cheek, I saved President Obama's life, because he came out of the dressing room with a string hanging out of his collar. And it was a brand new shirt, and he had a white string sticking up over his black tie, and he couldn't get it.
Yeah.
So he came around the corner saying, does anyone have a knife? And of course the outer room is full of Secret Service and high ranking staff, traveling staff, and the staff are not allowed to carry knives, so they're just kind of looking around. But every Secret Service agent in the room has a knife of some sort.
Yeah.
And so, and of course everyone wants to be helpful and supportive. So knives are popping up and I was close, but there was another agent that was even closer, but he pulled out a knife that to this day, I don't understand. I don't know where he was keeping this knife that he was then able to produce it and hand it to the president, which was completely awkward.
Yeah.
So President Obama takes this knife from the agent, kind of regretting having asked for a knife, I think. And he starts to go up toward his neck to cut this string. And of course, he's standing there in front of us, not in front of a mirror.
Yeah.
And it was one of those times when I'm not the highest ranking Secret Service agent in the room.
Yeah.
But I was the shift leader. And so there was a fair amount of responsibility on my shoulders. And I just said, you stop. And I yelled it because I needed him to stop that. I knew the knife would do a marvelous job of cutting the string, but I was also afraid that there was going to be some blood spilled with that string so close to the neck and the jugular vein right there. So But it was a great, and you know, I've told this story a few times, never on a podcast though.
Yeah.
Where, you know, it's the lesson beyond that is that if you're gonna call someone out, you better be prepared with a solution.
Yeah.
So if you're gonna call a problem, you better be bringing a solution. And yeah. And thankfully, what I had was one of those little Leatherman tools, and in the center of it was a pair of scissors. So so now I'm handing the president my key ring with a Leatherman and the scissors open, and we were able to cut the string, and no blood was spilled, and the president was safe, and no one's heard that story.
Yeah.
In fact, you know, this may be the first time this story's being told, because it's in the book, but I haven't told that publicly before. So
wow. That's funny. Who is the hardest to be a Secret Service agent for of the three that you?
Oh, wow. Great question. Great government answer. It kind of depended.
Yeah.
I was with President Clinton, and it was his twilight, the last year of his presidency. Yeah. And so he wasn't getting out a lot. There was, you know, it was after the whole Monica Lewinsky thing. And, and so he was really flying under the radar, so to speak, and sticking close to home.
Yeah.
President Bush loved to get out. And so, you know, in some respects, President Bush was the hardest because of all the activities that he liked to do.
Yeah.
He liked to run. He liked to fish. He liked to get out and go. And so that really caused us to have to up our game.
Yeah.
I remember walking out of the White House with Lynn Swann one day, and Lynn Swann from the Steelers was his national fitness representative. And I was talking with Lynn Swann about how President Bush really keeps us on our toes, because he went from – he could run just over a six-minute mile and keep it up for almost 3 miles.
Yeah.
And to be able to run with him like that is hard enough, but to carry all the gear – the weapons, the communications equipment, all that stuff, because if you were to get separated, say, from the vehicles and the rest of the crowd, you needed to have all of that equipment. So, you know, in some respect, President Bush was tough because he liked to do so much. He was so active. But on the other hand, President Bush was so easy to predict in terms of time. He put out a schedule and he stuck to it.
Yeah.
And that was pretty nice for us, because we like to plan as well.
Sure.
And so if you knew you were the limo driver for the evening shift, you knew you were going to be back by 10 o'clock because he's going to bed.
Yeah.
And if you were the morning crew, you knew you better be on your toes early, because he's going to appear first thing in the morning.
Yeah.
And so little mix of both. You know, he was tough in that he challenged our ability to stay in front of him and be active, but he was also very predictable. So that was kind of nice. And then the third president that I was with was President Obama, just as nice as he could be to us, and so professional. But he didn't have quite as many activities and things like that, but a little less predictable on schedule.
Interesting. I've got so many other things I want to ask you, but unless you have any wild and crazy stories you want to keep sharing, I can switch subjects.
Well, I'm hoping you're going to invite me back, so I'm going to save a couple.
Tease them out. There you go. Okay. What is the psychological profile of a Secret Service agent? So obviously, if you're going to be an FBI, you're this. I know I've heard you talk about investigation with protection. That's part of it. But more than that, how can they trust the most important person in the world with you? What about your psychological profile makes you a fit? Who do they reject? Who do they keep? What is, you know?
Sure. Well, I hope, and I'm counting on the fact that they still hire agents the same way and manner that they did when I came on. I suspect that the some of the standards have not been maintained the way older guys like me would like them to. But but
that's scary.
You know, to start with, the process is so long. If you're faint of heart over time and difficulty, you're not going to make it through the process. For me, it was over a year just to get to the point where you were submitted for a polygraph examination, a physical examination. They they test you. They really run you through the ringer. You're interviewed multiple times. They do a home interview with you as well to talk to either parents or a spouse, girlfriend, whoever's in your life. They do a full background investigation. They're going to go talk to your friends, your classmates, your teachers, parents, family. They really do an excellent job of sifting you ahead of time.
Yeah.
And all of that is to get you to the polygraph. And you have to sit through a polygraph that where they can ask you anything and everything. And if you don't tell the truth, then you don't get in. And if you do tell the truth and you tell them stuff that just isn't going to work, you're out. So yeah. It really was a high bar to make it through the background, all the interviews, to have all those requirements in place and then pass the polygraph. And it was tough. When I was hired, the rumor was that it was 1 in 10,000 applicants made it through. And that's, you know, I'm not bragging. That's just what it is, what it is. That's how many people were looking to get in. And I was very fortunate to get in.
Potential theme in your book. I've not gotten to read your book. You just handed me your book and I intend to read it. Is life lessons from a career as a Secret Service agent and, your desire to, you know, potentially, you know, help other people, because of your unique, experience. And so, would love to have you, you know, tell our listeners kind of some of the life lessons that you learned, that could be beneficial for everybody.
Sure. Well, thank you. The book was really born out of my career, and, I take stories from the Secret Service, the Barack Obama string story is one of them, but, I'm talking about, faith. I'm talking about your identity. I talk about decision-making and, preparing for opportunities that come about, guarding your heart, protecting yourself. But then I talk about, leadership, friendship, hardship, and then let's get on with the mission that we were put here to do. I think one of the greatest, lessons that I learned in the Secret Service was not something that they taught in the academy. It was just part of the culture of the Secret Service that's really distinct from other top federal agencies. And that is that Secret Service agents are armed with knowledge of the fact that wherever they go, they have to go get help. So whatever city in the United States, whatever state, whatever country and whatever city worldwide, and I went to 74 countries, so I can tell you this was repeated over and over and over. The first thing that a Secret Service agent does when they hit the ground is they go ask for help, because we're so small and the mission is so big that you arrive with your hat in your hand saying, I need help. Wow. And so if you're going to Des Moines, Iowa, or you're going to New York City, your hat is in your hand and you're asking for help because you know ahead of time that you can't do this job on your own. You're going to need help. You're going to need to collaborate and you're going to need assistance and local know-how. So to me, that was always a tactical advantage to know ahead of time that I can't do this on my own. So you go in with a collaborative mindset. Yeah. And I think that's a huge advantage for the Secret Service, both in the protection side of things, but also investigatively. We just collaborate and not everyone can say that. So I think that's a great advantage and that bleeds over into life. You know, if you think you're the lone ranger who can do life and do it to its fullest all by yourself, well, the only one you're kidding is yourself because we can't do that. We have to be collaborative. We have to be humble enough to receive help in life or it's just not going to go well for you.
Wow. I could tell we could sit here and talk and talk and talk, and we'll do a little bit more in the overtime segment. You know, last thing, it's obviously imperative. Where can we find you? Where can we get the book? When is the book supposed to be out? All of that.
Sure. The book is scheduled for release April 16. It's all over the internet. I mean, you can buy it from Amazon or Barnes & Noble, Target, Walmart, wherever. It's out there. It's called Cheating Death. I put on my website, kennethvalentine.com, I put a couple of options for ordering the book from all of those different places. But, there's also going to be an electronic and an audio version of it. So but it's scheduled for release April 16. Okay. And we'll see where it goes from there.
Two things I almost had you on Valentine's Day. That was the original plan, remember? It was supposed to be Valentine's Day. Hey, I'm going to have Ken Valentine on Valentine's Day, and plans changed. But last, and we'll end with this, why did you name the book Cheating Death?
Right. Well, Cheating Death was a term that we used within the Secret Service, and it was a way to remind ourselves of how important the mission is, because you show up to the White House every day for work. It might be easy day after day after day when nothing happens to forget how important your mission is. And so it was a good way to kind of remind each other in a playful way of the importance of paying attention to detail and staying and keeping your head in the game, because we're not, cheating the other team. We're cheating death. And death, we tend to protect people that somebody else wants dead. Mm. So important mission. It's a here and now mission, and it never stops. So good to keep your head in the game. For me, the title of the book kind of coincided with the way I see life. And cheating death is not just what we did on the president's detail, but it's what we do in life, because death wants us dead now. And death wins if we just live this mediocre, ordinary life. And you don't have to be a Secret Service agent to cheat death. I think we can live our best life. Jesus said that he came that we might have life and have it to the fullest, John 10:10. And that's the life that I want. And that's the life I want for my kids. I wrote the book originally to speak to my boys specifically, three boys, two girls, to tell them, hey, you don't have to settle in life for ordinary. And my new favorite Psalm 56 talks about how he saved me from death that I may walk with my God in the light of life. And so he's already cheated death for us and invited us to live an abundant life. And so how do we go about that? And that's what this book is. It's a manual for following the Lord and giving your life over to him, and then knowing and appreciating that abundant life that only he has to offer.
Amen. Ken Valentine, thank you.
Yes, sir. Glad to be here.
Awesome. All right, guys, you heard it there. KennethValentine.com. KennethValentine.com to go to his website. I'm sure the book will be available on Amazon. Cheating Death. You guys go out, get the book, read it, let everybody know about it. I think you guys will enjoy it. And until next time, put your trust in God and keep your powder dry.